Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SubDoc, a show where we talk about documentaries with guests from the worlds of comedy and film. On today's episode, I spoke with the director of Sex and Broadcasting, Tim K. Smith. Sex and Broadcasting is a 2014 film about New Jersey's long-standing freeform radio station, WFMU, and its struggles to stay afloat. Along the way, we encounter Tom Sharpling's best show, the recession, competitive fundraising, and all manner of seat-of-the-pants media stunts by the singular Ken Friedman, who's made it his life's mission to keep WFMU on the air. You can find Sex and Broadcasting on Netflix, Canopy, and iTunes. It should be out on DVD in the spring, and it's also playing at the CU Sound International Music Film Festival this January in Turin, Italy. And now, here's my interview with Tim K. Smith. Tim Smith, thank you for coming to my house.
Oh, thank you, George.
And you live in New York?
I live in...
Jersey.
I live in New York State proper.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a place called Nyack, which is about 20 minutes from the George Washington Bridge, but I spend my days in New York City.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're out here doing family stuff, or?
I have family out here, and I come out here also to meet with people in the business and do business stuff, mm-hmm. you know, about the future, and I like any excuse to come out here and have a good drink.
Yeah, yeah. And so... what we're going to mostly be talking about today is Sex and Broadcasting, which you made.
That's correct.
You're the filmmaker. And there's going to be listeners that are familiar with WFMU and have are probably a lot of Best Show fans out in the podcast land.
Sure.
But for people that don't know WFMU, what's been your quick description?
The short and simplistic description is WFMU is an independent radio station out of Jersey City, New Jersey, that is America's longest running freeform radio station. And so freeform being that they don't have one format, and each DJ is responsible for the curation and programming of their show. And it's run by a volunteer army of DJs. And it's truly independent in the sense that it gets no underwriting, which is a coded way of saying advertising in the public radio sphere. And it gets no, it has no strings attached money, that it receives. And it really survives on this one, on-air fundraiser that happens once a year. Usually once a year, it's sort of do or die for this, what is this little institution, but has a cult-like following all over the world. So it's the kind of radio station that you would, you know, walk into Tokyo and into a Tokyo, record store, and the shopkeep would be wearing a WFMU T-shirt, and they would be streaming WFMU over their ways. Or, you know, I get requests from, oh, the film's going to screen in the Ukraine or Macedonia it has this incredibly unusual and passionate following all over the world. And it is truly an unusual kind of programming that is both an expression of live radio, which is unusual today, and is also like these amazing archaeologists of the history of recorded sound, mm-hmm. Playing stuff that some days you'll be like, oh my God, where that was amazing. I heard this thing and I'd never heard anything like it. And then the other days, 5 minutes later, you'll turn on, they'll play something that just drives you insane. Mm-hmm. And you'll be like, oh my God, I can't, I can't stand that radio station. I would say on top of that, they have a very specific sense of humor about themselves. And so in all these moments of programming pretension or program ridiculousness or prank radio, you have this place that really can laugh at itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah, I think this sense of humor definitely is captured in the film. And what you're saying about one scene, if I was going to describe this to someone, one scene I always think of is them rolling in that the giant, like, is it a wax cylinder player or like some kind of like really old like recording device, and then like miking up the horn,
yeah,
and then having the little like plastic tube, like one of these old Victrola type things.
Well, that was a wax cylinder.
It was a wax cylinder player, yeah.
And so they have an amazing show, where someone just plays old 78s and wax cylinder recordings, and which basically requires them to use these old hand crank machines and then put literally a microphone up to it to broadcast it. And it's a beautiful sight to see. Yeah. And of course it's an amazing sounds to hear.
Yeah. Like I'd never had thought about like the fact that something like that wouldn't have, it would need to be a studio treatment for the machinery itself and not like these other, like a cassette deck or something.
There's no XLR out.
Yeah, no one has bothered to make that yet.
Yeah. USB.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard like people have been ripping 78s a lot. I've been seeing a lot of those things. But the fact that it is live, and I think like it's interesting that some, like say, like for example, like Best Show ended up being a hugely massive popular thing that came out of WFMU.
Tom Sharpling's show.
Yeah, Tom Sharpling and John Wurster. And they are now only a podcast. Mm-hmm. And then there is a way that you lose that live thing that you can only have in radio.
Well, I would say, that's true. So FMU, all of the shows, almost all of the shows, I should say, are live.
Mm-hmm.
And they have almost no pre-recorded transitional pieces. If someone's going to tell you about the programming coming up next, you're listening to a DJ tell you about that.
The person in the next room.
The person in the next room who's getting ready, who you can hear rustling, getting their stuff together. And I think when you first hear that, you're like, yeah, so what? Who cares? There is this aspect to radio that was very common, which is that you put radio on, you do other activities, you know, you're driving in your car, you're washing the dishes. It's a companion medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that you have with you. You very rarely sit in front of the radio and just watch the radio as it does its thing. Live radio, on the other hand, has this added component that some DJs really exploit. Tom Sharpling, I think, did that the best. Certainly Ken Friedman and his comedy show with Andy Breckman, 7 Second Delay, also do some of that. But and that's the sense that you're listening to something live, and at any moment, you have no idea what's going to happen next. And just the knowledge that this is, it's like watching a live event versus watching a film. You're sort of like, okay, I'm watching a film. It won't go off the rails at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it feels like something could go off the rails at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I think that's something that we should hold on to. I think it's a little bit like theater. And I love the fact that when I'm listening to someone like Tom, I am listening to somebody in the same moment that I am having all kinds of feelings, whims, suddenly turning on his audience, suddenly turning on himself in a... You know, drowning himself in self-doubt, then rallying in a, you know, just in a, he's going to fight the world, and you're going to come with him, and then we're going to lead into some Led Zeppelin, and we'll end it. So, live radio.
Yeah. Now, are you and I may be around the same generation in terms of, we were listening to a lot of radio before internet stuff. Like, you could only find out about a lot of weird music in the 80s and 90s through college radio.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And did you have an involvement, or how did you come to FMU specifically, or did you have an involvement in college radio in general?
So I moved to New York City in 1989. Mm-hmm. It was a different world. You know, certainly there was no internet. I had, you know, as a high schooler, that was the way I found out about new music, was two sources. One is you found college radio stations, and you know, you'd start to listen to certain shows, and you would sit, you'd have a piece of paper often near your radio, so you could write down.
That was Shazam.
What was that band?
Yeah.
I got to know that song.
Where did you grow up?
So I went to high school in the Boston area.
Record Hospital. Yeah.
WZBC mm-hmm. and Newberry Comics.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty rich time for music in the 80s in Boston, you know, college. Yeah,
for sure.
You know, I was a big Pixies and Throwing Muses fan. And
did you have a fake ID? You're getting on these shows?
You know, they had a pretty healthy, like, all ages experience. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was very lucky. Now we're getting really off into, there's only a few of you that will understand these references. Yeah. But
it's like our average demographic is in their late 30s, I think, at this point.
So, you know, one of the first shows I saw, you know, when I was in eighth grade, was I went to go see the Minutemen play at the Rat.
So that must have been 83, 84?
Yeah, it was for their last tour.
Oh, okay. So yeah,
well, it was for it was for the Merch.
Yeah, post-Merch.
Project Merch.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So I was very lucky. So when I came, to get back to FMU, you know, when I came to New York for college... Mm-hmm. And I got my little apartment, and the first thing I did was I said, I got my radio. And then so for people that didn't grow up listening to radio, you know, the dial is sort of split it's like one third and is the public radio sphere. And what does that mean? Well, the FCC, this government agency, basically says all this part of the broadcast spectrum is for public radio stations or nonprofit or things that serve the public good. That's mm-hmm. why, you know, when you're listening, you know, your parents' NPR station, it's always down there at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And then the hot 97s and the, you know,
10 whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is all there up at the top, the 100s and all that.
So, and that placement mattered a lot back then. Yeah. Because if you had, like, I worked at a station that was a 103. It was a Santa Clara University. And it was like, that seems like pretty central for a college station.
Amazing.
Maybe the fact that it was a Catholic school had something to do with it. I don't know.
Who knows?
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm sure that got them some real money in the Clear Channel era when they probably sold that bandwidth.
But I think they're still there, though. But yeah, like a lot of most college stations you'll find are in the 80s and the early 90s, basically. Yeah.
So I get to in New York, I get my radio out, I go down to the bottom of the dial, I'm trying to find some stations. New York City actually is a really, I don't want to say it's a lousy place for radio, but the combination of the high price of real estate and the combination of all that architecture makes radio signals really, they just don't travel well.
Mm-hmm.
And so there weren't a ton of great radio stations. And then I have my radio in one part of the room and I find this, I was like, oh, that's some great music. I'm going to leave my radio right there. It seems to be in tune if they come back there. I came back, you know, an hour later, turn it on. The music was so different. And I was like, this is not the same radio station I was listening to. And I had no idea what the, you know, the call letters were. And And it just went on like that for about 6 months until finally I was like, oh, this is this one radio station. It's called WFMU. And one day you're going to turn it on and be like, this is amazing. And the other day you're going to be like, what is this? Why I'm being tortured? It was a pretty magical thing. So I really came to FMU as a fan, a fanatic. Which can be a really good thing as a filmmaker. It can propel mm-hmm. you, but it can also be, you eventually have to get beyond that if you're going to mm-hmm. say anything of significance about this place or institution or person.
And we're live at WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. Glenn Jones, a DJ, about to break the record for the longest radio broadcast ever.
I think he's doing remarkably well, considering he's been on the air for 97 hours.
Four, bring the title back to America. Ladies and gentlemen, he's the heavyweight champion of the world.
I guarantee you, I don't care where you grew up, what culture you subscribe to, you're going to hear something that you like. I mean, eventually.
So let's get into a little bit what is your film background before this all came about?
I went to NYU and graduated and then became an immediate success.
That happens all the time, I hear.
Yeah, it's amazing how that happens, and that was me. So go to film school, everybody. Yeah. I came out of NYU, and oddly enough, I just because of some background, I'd been PAing all through college, and by the time I left college, I was doing a lot art direction and prop. I was a prop master, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. This was not necessarily my forte. It was just something I could make a living at, and it was probably a wonderful diversion for a brief period of years, but it allowed me to pay my rent, and I had some great experiences. And then eventually, as I was trying to continue to try to do just some direct some stuff, I eventually became an editor. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's where my life really begins in the documentary world. I got very lucky and collaborated with a guy by the name of Matthew Galkin, who we made two films together. One which I edited was called I'm an Animal, which was for HBO, which was about Ingrid Newkirk, who started PETA, which is really a portrait of a fanatic.
Yeah.
It's sort of the question of like, is this person a crackpot or a visionary? And then I made another film with him, which I co-produced and edited, which was about Jack Kevorkian.
Okay.
For HBO, called Kevorkian. And again, the questions of sort of crackpot or visionary come into play. And funny enough, in some ways, you could say the same about FMU.
Right. The leadership, and the the visionary.
Yeah. Aspect, yeah. Yeah, actually, I think Ken would be smiling right now if I
comparing him to Kevorkian.
If I had said, you are either a crackpot or a visionary, right. He'd be like, yes.
Yeah. When did you start thinking about doing this project?
Right after Kevorkian, mm-hmm. and this film took an enormous amount of time, and mm-hmm. there's some benefits to that, but. It was the struggle of a person who is trying to make a living. I support a family. At the time, it was 2009 when I first started shooting. So a long time ago.
Yeah.
And
I noticed there's a lot of time jumps in there, but I mean, it does follow a chronology up through the end. Up through the end, yes. But I noticed that, it seemed like a lot of time that you were shooting different areas.
I for anybody who's a filmmaker who's listening to this, it came at a time I had a young daughter, and she was at an age where I was like, okay, she doesn't need me quite as much anymore. I can now start making a film. Mm-hmm. FMU was in some ways a perfect subject because I didn't need a large crew. I shot the film, 90% of it I shot myself, and I could just go down to the station and hang out. And that worked for a lot of it. And then I came to a place where I was like, oh, I need to take this to the finish line. And that is, you know, I see a lot of films as an editor of films. I see a lot of people struggle. It's very, I would say it's very easy to start a documentary. It's very hard to finish a documentary. Mm-hmm. I eventually started Kickstarter and was relatively successful, and that enabled me to finish the film. You know, in 2009, the big story, of course, was going on was there was a financial crisis.
Right.
And I hadn't really anticipated that would play a part in the story, but it certainly didn't hurt mm-hmm. to have this thing that is always on the edge of failure now having an additional crisis that it was facing. Mm-hmm. So
I do like the way you structured, like, there was a couple of natural tensions and dramas that happen, which mm-hmm. is a lot of it have to do with the fundraising. Mm-hmm. Some of it has to do with Ken himself mm-hmm. and the sort of like personality struggles he has with different people in his quixotic attempt to keep this thing afloat. The financial crisis is one part of it. I like that some of the background stuff I wanted to know you addressed kind of in the back end of the movie, mm-hmm. like kind of like the beginnings.
Yeah, very
of,
late.
Like, with Uppsala and even the title, Sex and Broadcasting, which for those who don't know, that is like that's a line from the manual that he looked at, or the title of the manual?
That's the title of a manual. So there was a, I want to say, now I'm forgetting, but 1970s, 60s, 70s, late 60s, early 70s, community radio station starters kit, if you will. It was a book written by a guy named Lorenzo Milan, who was really Johnny Appleseed of community radio station. And if you go up and down the West Coast, almost, you know, he's responsible for a dozen radio stations. And he wrote this sort of gonzo book called Sex and Broadcasting that Ken Friedman read when he was in college doing radio. Mm-hmm. And he, in a weird way, when you just pick up that book and start to flip through it, you're like, oh, that energetically, that's FMU. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It's irreverent. It is about how do you survive another day to enjoy the chaos of having this odd community and do crazy radio.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's interesting to think of, like, the whole seed of the thing having to do with that era of counterculture, like the 60s counterculture, mm-hmm. and how basically you can kind of think of what they're doing as continuing the spirit of the 60s counterculture, and it's mm-hmm. gone through punk, it's gone through all these other eras, mm-hmm. but essentially that kind of freedom goes back to that origin.
Yeah, I would say that Ken and even Sex and Broadcasting, Lorenzo's book, were both sort of counterculture hippie energy and also counterculture.
Right, because it's both, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Ken would describe himself as a benevolent dictator. Mm-hmm. He will tell you that great community radio stations die because there's too much democracy. You know, some people would be like, what? That's crazy. But, you know, we had some great radio stations in the New York area. WBAI is certainly one of them. And there became a kind of balkanization within the organization of, you know, radio programs that would never go away, mm-hmm. Warring ethnic groups within them, trying to hold off their turf, and just programming that over time was about representation and not about necessarily great radio. Mm-hmm. I think that's a hard needle to thread there, mm-hmm. in terms of, well, how do we have community radio station that represents the community?
Yeah.
And, but I think Ken has been steadfast in trying to make radio that probably reflects a lot of his sensibilities, but is also just surprising. And he just kind of doesn't care where it comes from. Mm. They have this one rule, which is that anybody can be taken off the air, and they will be. You know, people will sit out. People who have been around forever will sit out, you know, 6 months, you know, and not have a show for a while.
Well, that's one thing I learned from this that I didn't know anything about was that there is this whole Jewish mourning show. Then that's like talking about a balkanized subcommunity. Like, I had no idea that that was part of FMU.
Yeah. So,
and that seems like a really huge part of it.
It, well, it's funny you should ask, talk about that, because so FMU, before Ken Friedman ever took over as station manager, before they ever bought the license from Uppsala College, there's been a show called Jam in the AM, which is called Jewish Music in the AM. Mm-hmm. And this is a show, a very conservative Jewish show. They play a lot of Jewish music, I think pre-internet, that you probably, if you were a Orthodox Jew living in northern New Jersey, you couldn't find anywhere else, and you were longing for community. And they had been there forever. And when I think Ken made a very practical decision to just keep JM the AM on, they had a big fundraising chunk of money that they seemed to make every year. It was unusual, but it was a happy, tolerant marriage. JM and AM is, I don't think there's, as Ken would say, there would be very little crossover in terms mm-hmm. of listenership. JM and AM went off the air this year.
Okay.
So this year's fundraiser was the first fundraiser that they've ever had where, you know, they had to do it without JM and AM.
The guys just retired or they
I had been hearing at the time mm-hmm. their fundraising had gone down more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Some of JM and AM were actually, Nachum Siegel, who's the DJ for that show, he made a small salary from that show. He was one of the only paid DJs. But again, because he had been on forever, and they were almost like a station
they were an island, yeah.
But I think the internet really changed everything. They were now competing with, you could just listen to Israel. You know, there's a ton of programming in Israel you could listen to every day if you want. Mm-hmm. You could listen to, there's just a lot more to compete with. FMU itself has been incredible at capitalizing on the benefits of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I think Nachum did not necessarily survive that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
this is the first year fundraising without them. And what you're saying, yeah, about there was two things that I know about that didn't really get touched on here. I think maybe they were just developing around 2011 mm-hmm. or 12, which was the Free Music Archive. And then at WFMU, Beware the Blog, which is amazing.
I mean, I could say those are two amazing things. This has to do with my personal approach to making a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell a story. I'm a storyteller. I want to tell a story, and I want there to be a cohesive point of view. FMU not only has the Free Music Archive, which is this amazing institution that they created sort of separate within FMU, which is this...
As like a nonprofit, I think.
As a nonprofit. Yeah. They actually got it as a part of the... There was a Paola lawsuit in New York, and they were able to basically get this massive funds grant to start it.
Okay.
And, but...
Oh yeah, and I wasn't saying that you needed.
Oh
to cover
no,
them.
Not at all.
Saying,
yeah, but I think it's actually
about how they've adapted to this environment.
Yeah,
how they're very tech savvy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm more making the point mm-hmm. that their FMU is so rich,
mm-hmm.
and it has. You know, I never talk about Brian Turner in the film.
That was one of my major questions because he's the guy I mostly know of. Because I've come at it from the music side, from being working at record labels, so I've always been sending packages to Brian for.
forever.
Since the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, so Brian Turner is the technically the program director there. What does that mean at a place like FMU where each DJ gets to play whatever they want? It means that basically he curates the new bin of everything that comes into FMU. He's the first ears that really help FMU DJs just get through this massive amounts of recorded music that is coming to the station.
And as
day.
Opposed to like often with college stations, you get someone who's only going to be around for 2 or 3 years because they're like by nature graduating.
Yeah.
There's people at FMU that have been there for since the 80s.
Well, people have been there before. Yeah. Ken, you know, there's another perfect example, you know, Irwin Chusid.
Right. Right. He was like a huge, he's known for documenting weird music, and he's got books about weird music, like incredibly strange music.
Yeah, incredibly strange music. Stuff that we would find kind of, I don't want to say ordinary today, but internet has changed things in the sense that, you know, these DJs, you know, right now I look at them as these amazing archaeologists and curators of sound, and they help to kind of take what is out there and bring it down and selectively make better choices for you.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a time when the things that they were playing, you could not find anywhere else.
Right.
There was no place to search online and say, oh my God, I heard this guy who plays, you know, his forehead.
Right.
And,
like,
you know,
people like Moondog or the Shags, you probably would not hear outside of like
Irwin
helped explaining
break
it to
the
you.
Shags. Yeah. Yeah. So, Irwin. And Irwin's story pre-Ken, FMU in the 60s had been a free-form radio station at Uppsala College in New Jersey. And then the school shut the radio station down, partly because of it was getting too wild. Mm-hmm. And Irwin, if Irwin was here, he'd tell the story better. But Irwin really was the person that brought freeform back at FMU in the 70s and was the thing that Ken heard that said, okay, now I got to come and help not only do this, but make this like a, in it, he, you know, he's responsible in some ways for carrying that flag from the previous generation of people that had been FMU DJs there and making it, you know, what it was. And he was there with, you know, our Stevie Moore and
the
making
Hound,
making really unusual radio station radio programming.
There's another question I had is, did you sit down with R. Stevie Moore? I feel like he'd be a tough interview. I don't know a lot about him.
You know, part of it was during the period that I was shooting. The short is no, I did not sit down with him. I did get some amazing tapes of his. He, you know, he did an incredible amount of self-documenting. I mean, his recordings, his musical recordings obviously are that, but he had a video camera and he would just bring it down to the station. And
some of that footage was the first I even realized that he had been part of that era.
Yeah, so he would just film himself doing, he did a show with this guy, the Vanilla Bean, and they just did really wonderful live, you know, unusual radio theater that just was always moving in unpredictable ways. So he was, you know, he was amazing. Those, so getting back to that, in some ways it was just like, where do you, what are the few things I'm going to focus on and kind of a knowledge like, you know, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes or I'm going to piss
well,
off
no
a
way,
lot. My mistakes is the wrong. I'm going to piss off somebody.
There's no way to do. And I mean, unless you were to do it as like, even if you did a multi-part series, it's like, this is a place that's been churning content nonstop since the 70s, 60s.
Yeah.
So there's no way you're going to cover everything. I did watch this one with my girlfriend who also had done college radio in New Jersey.
Yeah.
She went to Patterson and she had done college radio at the Patterson station. So she sort of, at one point we kind of stopped watching it because I was enjoying this from my perspective of like being a fan of college radio, being a fan of the film. And she was like, I feel like there is not a representation. If I were just to watch this as someone who is a woman who did college radio or did independent radio.
Right.
I feel like there is like a lack of representation of women. And that really struck me. And actually, that's like what I wrote on Facebook. And you got in touch with me regarding that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that touches on what we're talking about here. Like, there are, by nature of your editing, you're going to leave some things out. Were there more, like, female characters that could have been included? Or what do you think?
I spent there's a bunch of things to talk about.
Right,
one is,
a lot there, right?
I spent a lot of time shooting with a lot of people at FMU. Mm-hmm. When I first got there, I had no sense that I was going to focus on Ken Friedman. I thought about it in a more abstract way. I was like, this will be a series of portraits and we'll just follow them for a whole year and we'll start with one fundraiser and end with another. And it will, within that, we'll just meet these unusual human beings. You know, radio is not a great medium. You know, it's not a great subject for film.
Right. That's a good, yeah. Right.
You know, exactly. 90% of it is, and I found out very quickly, I was like, I go down this station, I was going to film with my favorite DJ, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to film them getting records out, putting records on. They're going to do sound break, you know, little musical breaks and to backtrack the music, maybe have a little banter, maybe say something personal, maybe not, and do that for 3 hours. It is really not a great, it's not, particularly if you're trying to tell a story with, you know, mostly verite footage, it's not great. And I learned that very quickly. And then I would get very easily distracted by, and I'm telling this, you know, as a filmmaker, I was so smart before I started making this film. I was an editor, so I was always taking people's footage and saying, okay, now this has to go away and this has to go away, and we're just going to focus on this, and here's your story, and it's not the thing that you dreamed of, but it's going to be so much better, and it's going to be like this, and yes, that you're going to piss off that person, and that's okay, because we're telling a real story, and it's truthful, and we're going to be proud. Mm-hmm. Very early on, I just got to this point where I was like, oh, I'm just going to keep shooting people. Because A, I was addicted to just being around FMU because I just love it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I'm going to go hang out with DJ Trouble. You know, mm-hmm. Very early on, I met a very young DJ. She was 16. She was on the air there. Very unusual. And she was suffering from some kind of immune illness. And so I thought, oh, well, that sounds dramatic to me. And maybe it'll be really about how FMU helps her get through the day and da, da, da. You know, you're trying to kind of connect the dots. Okay, that sounds dramatic. And movies are supposed to be dramatic and about people struggling with something. Well, you know, you shoot someone for, you know, 100 hours and you realize that's a whole nother movie. That's just a movie about a young girl who's doing a thing and who's struggling with something. And you have to go, I'm not making that movie. I'm trying to talk about the spirit of this place. Mm-hmm. Now, I will tell you, when I saw your note on Facebook, it plays right into the fact that, you know, I look back and I, you know, the limits of making a relatively low budget documentary, I carry around a lot of, not guilt, but, you know, not regret, but just this feeling of like, well, you know, God, I should have found a way to work Brian Turner in. You know, that feels, you know, he has an enormous amount of influence on how that place sounds and for a long time.
Yeah. And he's like the guy that I always associate. I didn't know who Ken was. I associated that place with him.
Right.
In my mind.
Yeah. So then you get into, well, what's going on right now? What's the story that I am trying to tell? Well, eventually the story that I was trying to tell is FMU is a place that should not exist. And what I mean by that is it is a place that by the rules of our society...
Capitalism.
Yeah, capitalism, or even just sort of pseudo non-for-profit-y story, it still shouldn't exist. They just keep moving in the... If there's a way they could make their lives easier, they will not do it. They just keep not doing the things. And if it weren't... And I was like, well, why is that? Who keeps it going like that? Why? What is it that is the fanatic... like view of it? Obviously everyone is sort of on board with this, but it kind of takes a crazy person to say, no, we're just going to keep doing this way, even though every year this causes me incredible stress. Every year we have to worry that our dream will die. Now, we've all known a great cultural institution, we've always known a great club, an amazing zine or magazine or record label, and then And they sort of arc, and then they sort of like die off. And and in the best situation, they become a kind of a museum version of themselves.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I very quickly realized, okay, as much as I really didn't want to make a film about one of these people, I very quickly realized Ken Friedman is the person that A, said, we're going to buy this station from this bankrupt college.
Yeah.
We are going to find a way to fight for it to be unlike anything else that exists. Every year when we have a struggle and we could just take some money or we could do what other people do or join NPR or whatever, he resists. Every month, and there are the I don't tell all of the years of the so many. There was a story we had in the film very late that it was about two NPR, actually I think it turned into three NPR stations that were suing FMU in their early years because there was a typo on the FMU FCC license that would have allowed them to cut the power of their very small antenna down to nothing. And that would have allowed them to expand their signal. It's a great story. I could just, you know, you could just go on. We could be, if I were filming right now, I would be telling the story of JM and the AM leaving FMU and them now having to go it alone. If I had been shooting all the way through Tom Sharpling leaving, I would have, although that's certainly a theme of this film, I would have done that also. So it, when I look back, I have, I shot with so many DJs. I remember Liz Berg, who is the assistant station manager, and in many ways is sort of the engine that keeps the lights on, and is not necessarily the fanatic that keeps everyone into this place of, okay, this is how we're going to do it no matter what, and that's just the way it is. You know, I look back and I go, Liz Berg should have been in this film more. And I when I saw that comment on Facebook, you didn't represent women better. It was very personal to me in the sense that, yeah, I kind of, there are a lot of hard decisions that I made. And some of them, I think, well, if I had had four more weeks, I would have done better.
You had interviews with those people, right?
Yeah, some
I imagine there were people that were, you have the footage, and there's some people that were like, actually, I don't want to be in it. I imagine you had a few
Some of those. There's a little bit of that. There's more of, I can remember Liz Berg saying to me, I don't think I want to be in this film because I'm just too damn boring. And, you know, she was sort of joking. But in many ways, the real struggle at that time was, in my mind, and the thing that resonated with me was, who keeps this crazy place alive? And then how, if you are a success at this place, how do you keep doing it when you put in so much and you get, you know, you get nothing in what we see as our society back? You get no monetary way of, you know, Tom Sharpling built one of the most amazing shows on WFMU, an incredible podcast at FMU through this show, a live radio event that happened every Tuesday night with John Worcester, who they did something amazing with live radio. They have amazing people come to them. They had giants of alt comedy coming on, Patton Oswalt coming on, mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, you had Paul Tompkins and John Hodgman in that show. You're in the room with them when they shot that?
Yeah. They were fantastic. He did something amazing, and he raised enormous amounts of money. And
that's like one of the most dramatic moments in the film.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're really facing, you know, crisis, and there's someone like Tom Sharpling who is giving more than a lot of people give to their full time jobs. Way more. Mm-hmm. This is a passion for him. He is killing it every time. And you feel at some point, well, what do you do? What does someone do with that? Mm-hmm. And there had been, you go back, you go, like, oh, well, here's a guy who did that before. The Hound. He was the first Tom Sharpling.
Star to come out.
Star. Now, you know, if I were going to be honest, you know, my favorite, you know, I have a lot of different favorite DJs. A lot of them aren't in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't. It didn't speak to anything. It didn't speak to these themes, and that's ultimately the choice that I made.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of DJs that come in. They love FMU. They do decent fundraising. They come in once a week. They have some records that they picked out over the week. They play them on the air for an hour, maybe 3 hours tops, and then they're done. That was not the story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah. Even like Adam Horovitz, like, hey, let me do this. And they're like, yeah, you're going to have to do all the shit work that a shit worker at a station has to do. And it's like, now there's things like Apple Beats and like Spotify where they would, they would be killing to have Adam Horovitz like doing a radio show for them. And like, FMU could have just been like, oh yeah, this will bring in like a huge following, but they're just like, no, you got to play by the rules.
It's kind of they were.
It's kind of like a hilarious scene, like 10 minutes in, I'm like, oh god, they just totally let that fall.
They let that go away. But in a weird way, I mean, I think it had to live in that. It has to live in that realm of like, okay, yeah, we're not going to be the people that are just like, oh, you mean there's somebody who's a celebrity that wants to come in and do a radio show?
Yeah.
Even though, you know, Ad-Rock has great taste and he would kill it. You know, mm-hmm. he would be amazing.
He's not going to go answer phones and open mail at like 2 a.m.
No, he's not.
No.
People who are discovering WFMU, they want to know what it's about. I say, tune it in. If you don't like what you hear, turn it off, come back an hour later.
When you go away.
And you may like what you hear. And then 5 minutes later, we'll drive you away again.
Well, okay, so do you... Now, I feel like a lot of the beef between the Hound, who, like, yeah, so if we go into the Hound, he had, like, the first kind of, like, he introduced people like Hazel Adkins and that whole genre. He was kind of basically a guy who brought that to the airwaves in the 70s.
Absolutely.
And...
really in the 80s.
So kind of... Does he predate Ken, or he's a little bit more contemporary?
No, he brought Ken.
He brought Ken in.
I mean, I'm sorry, Ken brought Jim Marshall in, yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's a little beef between those guys, it seems like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's documented in there. Was there stuff that you cut out from those talks that was like more personal, or was it like it was just mostly like he just felt like he got...
I think we properly represented that relationship. Yeah, the Hound, I think he loved his status as a guy who got kicked off of FMU. He right. likes his outlaw status as a guy. He's banned. Banned from FMU.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, he did an amazing show. Really, really great, cool music.
What is your relationship with Ken like? That's what I'm wondering, because it seems like as this thing went on, you started to focus more on him.
Yeah.
And that wasn't initially your plan, like you said.
Yeah.
What is your personal relationship with him like?
It's very good. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the sense that Ken was, I think, for very early on, very open. He wanted it to... I think his biggest fear was that someone would bother to make this documentary and it would be boring. And there had been for years people trying to make an FMU documentary.
Okay.
So when I first came... Ken was very smart in the sense that everybody who had come along and had tried and shot for a couple of years, he basically said, okay, if you're not going to finish it, you have to give me your footage. And so I inherited hundreds of hours of stuff.
Wow. Okay. So some of that stuff is stuff that other people had shot for abandoned projects.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So yeah, that when you see like, oh, I'm looking at, you know, DV footage of Joanna Newsom. That wasn't me.
Yeah.
But there's some amazing pieces of footage in there.
Yeah.
And I'm incredibly grateful. You know, look, when the film was just about to come out, I think Ken was understandably panicked about the release of the film.
About how it made him look? Or no, about how...
I think, you know, FMU is this incredibly, it's like, you know, it's a, in a weird way, it's a brand, you know?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You know, I hate to put it in those terms. There's probably a better way outside of this culture to talk about it, but it's something.
It's like a lodestone for a lot of people, like in this subcultures.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like a secret handshake when you see somebody with an FMU t-shirt on.
You're I see bumper stickers on Los Feliz all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I know who you are.
Yeah.
You know? And so in that sense, I think he worried at moments like, oh, he's gonna screw this up. You know, like
about you,
yeah.
He put his all trust in you to be.
Yeah, he had seen that when the first time he saw the film. I think his first reaction was like, "Oh my god, it's not boring." That was it. Oh, it's not boring. And then later on, it was like, "Oh, I think you know, self doubt and fear, and is this going to suddenly go out to the world?" And then once it suddenly went out to the world, then. The load came off. You know, any normal human being, A, is going to have a lot of apprehension about having a film made about them.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, I think he, he wasn't so sure. He just wanted to make sure we didn't destroy that beautiful, precious thing out in the world.
Well, I know, like, sometimes when people make a documentary about someone, then that person ends up being kind of like a co-producer, or they kind of like, or in the case of like someone's like, oh, I get the like their life rights or something like that.
Yeah.
In this case, it's the life rights of an institution, so it's not like exactly one.
Yeah, I had no agreement on that front with them, and I challenged the world to make a narrative feature about WFMU. Although you know that would be a beautiful thing, yes, I think to Ken's credit, he had an open door always. He made it so that other people, you know, and FMU is a paranoid, you know, it's full of paranoid people. It's a group of DJs. DJs don't like to talk to other human beings. They just want to sit in front of a microphone in a room by themselves and talk and be listened to. In some way, that's ideal, but the idea of actually having someone there and having a camera.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to picture it like some of these, like the Sue Braun. She's like, I don't like these fundraisers because I don't like this idea of forced fun.
Yeah.
That's a good quote. These tend to be antisocial people. And you're sitting there, and they probably don't want to talk to you in between playing songs, and you're sitting there for like for like years trying to get something out of them.
I'm like, come on, please. Yeah. And Ken, you know, vouched for me, and in that sense, I'm incredibly grateful. Mm-hmm. And he never asked me to take anything out of the film. Mm-hmm. He never said, "Oh my God, you know, you can't put that in there." You know, there's always some concern about representing all that is FMU, and that's impossible.
Right. Yeah. I noticed that you also had some talking head interviews with Lee Ranaldo and Matt Groening.
Yeah.
Did you, there's not a ton of Matt Groening in there, but do you go meet up with him?
I knew he was an FMU fan, mm-hmm. and, I eventually got a hold of him, and he was just fantastic. I flew out and, went out to his very cool headquarters, and he nailed it. You know, I mean, in some ways, what do you want from him? He's not going to tell you any personal information about the station. You want someone at the beginning of a film to vouch for the subject, so right. that people are going to go, "Oh, I like Matt Groening. I love The Simpsons, and this guy loves this place. Okay, I'm listening a little more carefully." And ultimately, that's why you have people like that in there. You know, Lee could speak a little more personally to FMU.
He's a New York guy,
because he's a New York guy. He played there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they were. I was very grateful to both of them. You know, there were a lot of people. Laurie Anderson was supposed to be in the film, and unfortunately, you know, my attempts to interview her happened just as Lou was passing, and that was really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's Cindy Sherman. I spoke to her about being in the film, and that sort of almost happened.
Is she a big listener?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I was just like, you know, I would have loved that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's, you know, you just keep trying, and in some ways... you know, I would say a documentary, it really is a collaboration between yourself and the subjects. Mm-hmm. And if someone never wants to talk to you, if someone, you know, is when you're around, it just stops expressing themselves, then, you know, at the end of the day, their role gets more and more diminished. Mm-hmm. That doesn't speak to the gender issues that you're talking about. I think I had a lot of great women that spoke to me. Certainly Sue Braun is one of my favorite people at FMU and one of my, you know, just person I love to listen to. It's funny, I don't even love her programming as much as I just love to listen to her be a crank on the radio. It just makes me feel not so alone in the world. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's...
it's something where you feel like if you either had more time or... we're not going to focus as much on Ken. It's just a decision you made.
In the last 2 weeks of editing, after a number of screenings, I cut out 30 minutes of the film. In those 30 minutes, probably about 20 of them are just portraits of DJs. You know, we go home with Dwayne, or we go home with Faye, who does a great show on Sunday nights called Hello Children, one of my favorites. And, you know, we go home with Fabio, who's got an amazing record collection. Is funny and
is he the guy with the fur coat? Is that Fabio?
No, that's Kenny G.
Kenny G. Okay, yeah.
Who's always getting in trouble. So yeah, it's I sometimes go back and go, oh, I should have left that in. You know, the filmmaker in me was like, I just want this to move, and that's. It's a hard thing when you have this sense of responsibility to representing people and their lives. You know, journalism is no different. You're cutting out things that you see and you decide who you're going to talk to, and every moment is a decision, is an editorial decision. So I'm sometimes I have these moments of disappointment. I'm very proud of the film. I think the film captures the spirit of what this place is. It doesn't tell. It certainly can't and doesn't tell all the kinds of stories that are there.
Was there, because like if I was going to think about approaching the idea of doing a documentary about a radio station. Maybe it is more like doing something about like a high school or something. Or like, what are some other models of like how to think of how did you thought about approaching the whole project?
I mean, I
was there
I,
anything
I,
like
yeah.
you were like looking at like oh like the up like Michael Apted or something or like
no, you know, I was being very foolish about it. You know, as someone who had been in post production for so long, you first thing you're not disciplined about when and who you shoot. Shooting, particularly if it's not very expensive for you to do, can be addictive. Mm-hmm. There's a thrill, you're going to go out. There's a sense of completion at the end of every day, regardless of sort of what happened. You're out trying to catch magic. And sometimes you feel like you caught magic and you didn't at all. And sometimes you just feel like, okay, I don't know what my thing is about. I'm just going to keep going. Mm-hmm. I need more DJs. I need to talk to more of them. Well, the more you talk to them, the less you're talking about anything. They all are, you know, they sort of talk in chorus a little bit, and you get some of that in the film. But some of them just, you know, they don't care about, you know, I mean, they care, but they're not going to passionately talk about the problems that you've decided are the things that make this resonate for you, the mm-hmm. questions you're trying to answer as a filmmaker. So yeah, going back to like, if you're going to make a documentary about your high school, well, first you got to choose a class. Which class are you going to focus on? Yeah. You know, and then within that class, who are those people? Like, think of all the different stories that are going on in your high school class, a graduating class. Is it, you know, is it the prom queen? Is it the artist that's, you know, building their own, you know, treehouse magical life? You know, is it, you know, what are you trying to say? And ultimately you're like, well, I really want to talk about, you know, people on the edge of tomorrow, you know, what the of adulthood or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. If those people don't speak to those themes, you better be cutting them mm-hmm. because they just muddy your theme. You muddy your story. So, you know, one of the women said to me, the men here are crazy. And I was like, oh, that must be why most of them are making the cut. Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, traditionally it is a field that has a lot of antisocial people and, yeah, a lot of outliers. Oh, I wrote something about an ant invasion. I had kind of forgotten about seeing that the first time through when I was watching it today. I'm like, is that like a recurring, just that building?
Every year they get
they have an ant invasion.
Massive ant invasion.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, they have you know, animals in the... in the roof, the whole back of the building was about to fall off recently that they had to shore up.
Do they own the building?
Yes.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So there was a reference to like there's a tenant downstairs during the recession that they lost. And to bring it up to date, they have a performance space down there now.
Yes.
Is what I was seeing?
So FMU is in... They used to be in Uppsala. In East Orange at Uppsala College.
Right, the entire campus had gone into bankruptcy and they were like the only functioning building with electricity.
They were on an abandoned college campus during a very bleak economic time. People would come onto the campus at night and just...
Squat and
fire off assault rifles. Yeah. Ken was smart enough to say, okay, we need to move to a new space. And they eventually bought a building. So they made a home in Jersey City before Jersey City became, you know, a new version of Brooklyn, mm-hmm. which it's slowly becoming and is big, you know, it's expensive. And so they were very lucky. They had a tenant on the bottom floor when I was shooting there. And then the recession, you know, killed that business and they went away. And they, instead of just trying, again, this is a Ken thing, instead of, oh, we need to find something to get that income coming back in to help, you know, support us, he was like, let's just make a performance space instead.
All the money's in performance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a limit. You know, I don't think it's
their connection that makes sense, that people would trust them to curate something like that.
Right. Yeah. And they're on Montgomery Street, so they named it Monty Hall, named after the game show host. It's a, you know, it's an amazing space and an amazing addition. And I, you know, I Ken just, and that whole station continues to grow and do amazing things. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And you were saying, so you actually debuted it at the end of 2014.
At Doc NYC.
Doc NYC. And then you did a few festivals. And
I did a lot. You know, we did some amazing festivals. I was in Europe quite a bit. I was at Rotterdam. So that was a big deal. And we, and then we did a nice theatrical run. Mostly on the east side of the country and a little bit abroad, but we were 9 days in Manhattan at the IFC Center, which was a thrill. I'm certainly helped that FMU is sort of like a home cultural institution. In many ways, the film had a, I can say financially, but it had it as big a life as I could have hoped.
Yeah, you know? And now it's available on the streaming services like Netflix
and Sundance Now and iTunes and Amazon.
And Canopy. I'll give a shout out to Canopy because that's Canopy. How I found it. My girlfriend found it at Canopy. If you're at least a LAPL member, you can watch documentaries on there for free. What's the most extreme feedback you've gotten from anyone who is either in it or just from fans?
Could
be positive or negative.
There's I get a lot of, oh my god, I can now explain this place to people. Mm-hmm. A lot of DJs come to me and thank god now I can try to explain this to my parents, you know, 50-year-old DJs who are like, now I can finally explain this to my parents. That's really great. I think every once in a while someone's like, I feel like you really didn't cover this aspect of the station, or even cover me in this, and
some of that you'd done interviews with?
Or? Some people I did interviews with. Some people that felt very reluctant during the process, and then kind of I was like, well, they don't seem really like interested in this. It is a collaboration. People can be very careful, when you're being filmed, and if that trust hasn't been built, or if that trust never can be built, then it just is what it is.
Right, with the paranoid people and whatnot,
So to a certain extent, that as a filmmaker, you on one hand, you have to be a little bit immune to that, but as a human being, someone spends their life working on something, and someone comes along to document some part of that, and they're not representative, there's going to be disappointment. Mm-hmm. And I at the end of making this film, for all the money I raised during Kickstarter, I spent a lot of money, and I spent a lot of time. And years away from my family, years away from my daughter, years away from whatever the next project was going to be, and certainly years away from making money.
Did you have to put off work to actually? You put off all paying work.
There was the last year where I finished the film and I had raised this money on Kickstarter. I was like, okay, great. I'm a great editor. I will just sit down and edit this myself because
Your background. You're an editor. Right?
Yeah, I'm an editor. So, and that was a disaster.
Did you have to bring in someone to help?
I ultimately brought in a guy who we had worked with for years together, and that was great. I required having someone else in the room to have a conversation with, someone who could be like, that's boring.
You're so close to it at this point, right?
Yeah. Well, and I'm also looking at my own footage, an editor who shot a film. So imagine what that looks like. Yeah. By the end of shooting, I was quite proud of some of the stuff that I shot. It looks quite beautiful. But when you're in the cut trying to make decisions, you can't just go like, that doesn't matter. You get hung up on your own, what feel like failings. So,
Working with someone that you're already used to working with, that was very helpful. Did anyone else come in to give you feedback while you're putting the whole thing together?
I have a process just from making other films of having screenings with people that I know are going to give me hard and constructive feedback.
Mm-hmm. Some private stuff.
We would just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to bring a dozen people. And actually not as eight is, I think, tops, at some point it's just a noise. And, and you just
little market research. Yeah,
kind of, yeah. But you look. You want to there's in any film, particularly in a documentary, you're like, is there anything that is confusing? That's number one. You want to just clear that out. And sometimes mm-hmm. You can't see it.
Yeah.
There's no way you can see it. And at some point you're like, oh yeah, I need to make that less confusing. Is there any, you know, are there places where you're just like, I am so bored out of my mind? You want to know that, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to try to get a, you know, diverse enough group where you're like, oh, that person loved that moment. So mm-hmm. that stays in.
But you end up cutting half an hour kind of near the time you had to submit it for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. You said you're out here doing other kind of business related things. Do you have any other projects that you can talk about?
I have been doing a lot of editing since then. I just worked with a director by the name of Dan Cloris on a 20-hour documentary on the history of basketball that will be on ESPN in 2018.
Okay.
I am turning a lot of my energy towards screenwriting until the next documentary takes a hold of me and squeezes every last dime out of my wallet.
Yeah, I guess screenwriting has got to be a completely different skill set because you're like, you can just fantasize whatever you want, and it's probably like you don't have to sit around and like collect all these hours of footage and everything.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. It's a very different, you know, obviously. You know, a screenplay isn't a finished thing. It's an inspirational document. It's a thing where you're hoping that other groups of people will rally around you and we will go off to make something together.
Is it about a madman visionary? I see the one through line.
It actually is. It is a little bit about a crackpot or a visionary. Yeah. It's that is, you know, I'm inspired by people that are trying to do things that aren't necessarily going to reward them in the traditional ways, and then they're a reminder of, you know, of things that are outside of all of this noise. You know, like, hey, someone built a place, a community where people come, and there's a sense of there's a it's a family. Mm-hmm. FMU is a family of people that feel like they need a family, mm-hmm. and they have a place where they can share their sensibilities and their music with a very diverse, you know, people all over the world.
Right.
And they're not, no one's going to get rich off of it. If anything, everyone's just going to lose money.
Yeah. There's something like utopian about the idea of it. And if not actually in the practice, I don't know if I would say it's a utopia in practice, but it feels like a utopia in theory.
I think it's a practical utopia.
Okay.
In the sense that, and that it's like, we aren't going to get bogged down by idealistic process. We're going to focus on these couple of core things, and within that, within these parameters, we're going to be incredibly free in a way that you will not find anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Great. Tim, thanks so much for coming over here and talking to us about sex and broadcasting.
Thank you, George.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
If you have comments, corrections, or want to suggest a documentary, email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
The show is listener supported. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you can't donate financially, please subscribe, comment, or tell a friend about SupDoc.
We'd like to thank Documentary News for their ongoing support.
SupDoc is produced by Will Scoble.
Our theme music is by David Siegel.